Good evening. This is the Voice of America in Washington. Welcome to another edition of Reporters Roundtable. I'm Douglas Impoga. This evening, we'll talk about the fate of opposition political parties in Africa. And joining us tonight are my colleagues, Blessing Zulu of VOA Zim Service. Welcome to the show, Blessing.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
We also have Vincent Macquarie, host of VOA's Africa 54. Vincent, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, and it's a pleasure.
You're very much welcome. And joining us from South Africa is regular panelist and friend of the show, Suleiman Mgula. He's an independent political analyst. He joins us by phone from Durban. Welcome to the show, Suleiman.
Thank you very much for inviting me and giving it to our listeners.
You're very much welcome. Now, gentlemen, our topic tonight is I don't think I can. There's much I can add from the east from the east to central to wherever opposition parties seem to be facing a hard time in trying to do their work. In some countries, it's almost impossible. The leaders of these parties are beaten, jailed, harassed. Some of them can't even organize rallies or carry on with their activities. So where do we start? Let me start with Blessings here, because in Zimbabwe especially, the last election was not as bad as the previous one as far as the option is concerned. How do you assess the status, the fate of the opposition there?
I think it's still a bit problematic if we can look at the report by the European Union, which essentially said that although there was no violence, the election was far from being credible, and the opposition is complaining that the field was not level, and it's still difficult, and there are also laws, some that date back to Rhodesia before independence, like the Public Order and Security Act, which was called Law and Order Maintenance Act during the colonial era. Mm. It only changed in name only, but there have been efforts to try and challenge that law in the courts. And yesterday, the courts did rule that, some of the provisions of that act are actually unconstitutional. Mm. So it's still a tall order for the opposition in Zimbabwe. Though, of course, Mr. Mugabe was ousted in November last year. Mm. Things have not changed that much.
I see. Have you sent in the neighborhood of East Africa there, you have Uganda, where being an opposition party member is almost risky. You have in Rwanda, I don't think there's even anything worth being called opposition parties.
Yes.
Tanzania, since CM has been powerful this long, it's very, very tough now to be in the opposition. Kenya is a little bit in the mix. So your general assessment first before I go to the nitty-gritty.
Yeah, I have to say that actually Kenya has done better when it comes to accommodating opposition views and opposition parties. Mm. And it was a struggle. It took many years of people dying, people being killed and jailed. But if you look closely, and that is what sets Kenya apart from Rwanda and Uganda, and even if you go down to south to Zimbabwe, it was all about a change in the constitution of the country. Mm. We know that the colonial constitutions we inherited were basically authoritarian. They did not allow for an opposition. They didn't, and then they vested all the powers on those that are in power, are running the government. Mm. So the government of the day has the powers to decide whether you breathe, or you smile, you jump, you die, or you live.
Yes.
And therefore, opposition parties have never had a chance because the big man who wields all the powers, you're at his mercy and his goodwill, and you're hoping that they can allow you to operate in that space. So at the core of it, if you look at the Kenya model, is that there was a fight, there was a struggle to repeal the constitution initially, but later on actually to write a brand new homegrown constitution that gave a space, provided for different political parties and made them legal and give them kind of protection under the law to operate within that space.
I see. Suleiman, Vincent here mentioned the idea of the having changed the constitution and making things better. But in some other countries, despite doing that, the constitutions have not helped the opposition.
Yes, they helped the opposition because, as my brother Vincent has said, right from the inception, I think one of the anomalies that happened on the continent was the misunderstanding of the role of the opposition by many of the political actors. The current dictators whom we have don't seem to appreciate that the opposition are a necessity to good governance. They are not opposing, but they are alternative views in a country. And they are necessary so that in case of any mistakes committed in the country by a regime, there is someone to keep them on their toes. There is an alternative, their alternative views. Number two, it spreads the human resource of the country, that while some good ones might be in government, there are also good ones who are left out and who can help a government to remain on its stories. In the absence of the opposition, for sure, there is no country, there is no governance at all. That is why our countries, those which are rotten, they are rotting more. That is why there is no even room, not because of just the constitution, because the leaders themselves have failed to understand the good importance of the opposition as far as good governance is concerned.
I see. Blessing, there's this issue that people have said, you can't talk of a meaningful opposition in a country where the ruling party has assumed all the institutions. They control the army, they control the police, they control the judiciary, they control, as Vincent said, the air you breathe. In that situation, is it real asking too much to expect opposition parties to have a say and compete for power?
It's very, very difficult. I think if you compare to America, for example, although I'm not saying that everything is okay in America. America has got its own problems. You had, for example, the alleged Russian interference in the American elections. But at least, you know, there are institutions that work. You know, you can at least go to the courts. You know, though some might say there were problems with the elections, there's an investigation that is going on that many feel is genuine. But unfortunately, for most African countries, the judiciary is captured, the military is captured. There are no checks and balances. You know, the parliament just rubber stamps whatever the executive is doing, and as a result, we have this deficiency when it comes to democracy. So I think those are some of the issues that really need to be addressed in Africa, because, you know, if there's this lack of democracy, it's proved that, you know, even the economy does not perform well. You know, most of these countries that are struggling, you can see that, you know, when it comes to the political leadership, it's actually contested. Therefore, you have problems. Zambia was making progress, you know, but now with President Lungu, you see is actually very hard on the opposition, and the country is troubled and owes China a lot of money, you know, and there are no checks and balances. You know, you go to Mozambique, of course, there's leadership renewal with a new president and all, but there are still problems with RENAMO. Alfonso Tlakama is late, of course, and RENAMO is a new leader, but still there are these fights, and it's not at all good for even economic development.
Listen, talking of these institutions, talking about Kenyan experience, in the last election, because of the new constitution, as you said, the Supreme Court came out and nullified the election, which was the first in Africa. But although they cowed down later, or some people say it was a bit political, or they got intimidated a little bit, but that, I think, goes a long way to show you that if you have working institutions, things can be put in check.
You know, here's what one has to realize. Kenyans were putting their new constitution to work for the first time. Some of it you have to be seen as, the teething pains. We came up with a brand new constitution that never existed. And in so many respects, some aspects of it had not been put to practice. So, for example, the Supreme Court, for the first time, was going to exercise its independence and made a judicial decision despite of the position of the president, who is very powerful, who was threatening the judiciary, but they dared the president to do anything because the constitution provided for the independence of the judiciary. So what is becoming a safeguard for Kenyans, and now they have the courage to move forward, is that there is the law that protects different entities, including political parties, and provides that it's legal to register a party and it's legal to operate within that space as an opposition party. But before we got here, if you go back to the year 2002, or even way back then, when the opposition won the election with Mwai Kibaki and Raila Odinga, it was literally a revolution. There were, under these old dictatorial constitutions, you cannot, for example, win an election because the Supreme Court, all the courts are controlled by the government of the day. The police system are controlled by the government of the day. So, to win an election as an opposition group literally had to be a revolution. It is like people literally uprising against the system, such that it was not necessarily the government of the day acquiescing to the fact that people have, you know, put their ballots and they've selected another person.
Yeah.
But with the fight to entrench a new constitution, now Kenyans can freely express themselves. Unless and until such happens in Zimbabwe, in Uganda, in Rwanda, there will never be a chance for the opposition.
Yes, but Suleiman...
Douglas.
Yes, go ahead. Go ahead.
I wanted to say that if we take an example of South Africa, I can assure you one thing. We are running the best economy on the continent, but without the opposition... Without a strong opposition, we would have collapsed several years ago. It is the opposition, however small we have. We have got young parties like EFF, the one led by Malema. We have got the Democratic Party, which has got the former experienced white people who are in government. We have got another one, UDM, which is led by Holomesa, another senior politician. We have got another one called COP, which is led by Lekota, another senior politician. We have got Inkatha Freedom Party, led by Buteresi, who is a senior politician and who by himself is capable of being a president of this country. All those ones are capable of being presidents of this country. And how have they helped? There are years where they have unasked high corruption, which would have been untouchable and which would have led to this country to collapse. The state capture which happened during President Zuma's government, if it was not the opposition, South African economy would have collapsed. But the opposition took ground and corrected the situation. Right now, there are changes which are being made just because of the opposition being strong. Look at countries like Ghana. The progress which they have made is because there is a strong opposition. The political parties in Ghana are exchanging hands in government, which has led to Ghana to progress. So without an opposition, whatever they are doing in Uganda, in Zimbabwe, in Rwanda, they are sinking the countries down. Let them like it or not, but there won't be any progress. That is why even Zimbabwe had a collapse because of lack of opposition. Nobody to keep you on your toes.
Well, for those joining us, you are listening to Reporters Roundtable, and we are coming to you live from VOA Studios here in Washington. Our topic tonight is the fate of opposition political parties in Africa. Panelists are my colleagues, Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe Service, and Vincent Makori, host of VOA's Africa 54. And Suleiman Mugula, an independent political analyst. And I'm your host, Douglas Impuga, here in Washington Studio One. Suleiman just went through a litany of issues about political parties. But isn't it asking too much for when we say there are countries? You mentioned Rwanda, you mentioned Uganda, you mentioned Burundi. There are several on the continent where being an opposition tantamounts to being an enemy of the state. Where the army swears, like in one country I had, they said they swore that if the opposition leader took power, they would not salute him.
That's Zimbabwe.
Yes. I think even in Uganda they did the same. So in that climate, in that environment, what options are there for the opposition?
I think, like Vincent has alluded to, the opposition just has to continue fighting. And also, I think what is worrying for Africa is that there are no peer review mechanisms. President Thabo Mbeki was trying that with the African Union. But unfortunately, many analysts say it's just an old boys club. You know, they don't realize that if there is democracy and Africa is united, you know, they can negotiate better deals, say, with China, with the European Union, with the United States of America. But, you know, that does not exist. So I think for the opposition, it's important to continue fighting for reforms, you know, knowing that, you know, for most African countries, their approach is that, you know, if you stay close to a cemetery, you don't have to mourn for everyone, you know. So you really have to fight on your own. You know, I like what Bobi Wine is doing in Uganda, for example. You know, he is putting Uganda back on the map and showing that, you know, there are problems there. And, of course, there are a few strongmen at least left with the departure of Mugabe. You only have Paul Biya in Cameroon, and also Yoweri Museveni in Uganda. So it is a long process. You know, they should continue to fight, because what is happening in most countries, they are not elections. It's what is called electoralism. You know, it's just a ritual that you are going for elections. You know, in most countries, it would appear as if it's better for them to announce the results first before going to vote. That's the dilemma. And as a result, you end up having people who don't believe in elections. Now, if you don't have people who don't believe in elections, it leads to war, because people feel that, you know, even if I vote or not, nothing will change. And then they become rebellious. And it's actually costly. Look at what is happening in the DRC. You know, those are some of the problems that have to be confronted. But the opposition, it might be tough, you know, but they should no other option. You know, they only have two choices. It's either they fight or they fight.
Vincent, there are in African countries, there are those which are strong men, and they are strong men. He says you can fight. He's mentioned the idea, the example of Bobi Wine in Uganda, who is energizing the youth and to demand for their power, to get their power back from the dictatorial government. But there are those in Rwanda, for instance, for the last elections, whoever has tried to contest has ended up in jail. So this is why you can agitate and use the mass movement and change stuff. So Kenya is nearing is on the right track, sort of.
Kenya is moving.
But then there are those countries where it's almost impossible, because now the ruling regime is merged. The party is the government. The government is the party. The army is the party. So there it becomes a bit almost impossible to dismantle that kind of thing.
You know, Africa has gone through stages, but some countries have moved beyond the second stage. Africa was colonized by Europeans, and African countries liberated themselves from colonialism. But the colonial powers handed powers, colonial type of authoritarian powers to African leaders, and these tribal chiefs enjoyed the powers that came with this colonial authoritarian type of regime. It's so sweet. They enjoyed it. What has happened is that in some countries, like Kenya, there has been a second liberation. That is the liberation from authoritarianism.
Second wave.
That is it. Africa has to go through, first, liberation from colonialism, liberation from authoritarianism, and then eventually there will be probably liberation from poverty. many African countries are now struggling and have to realize that they have to liberate themselves from authoritarianism, which is not so different from colonialism. Mm. And those so-called benevolent dictators were not any different than the British or the French who claimed that they were
helping
you because you are not smart enough, because there's nobody else good enough to govern an African country. Mm. And these people are telling you, it is only him and his son, probably a daughter, who can govern your country, or their ruling party. Ruling parties have become almost like they're not any different than the colonial powers. Mm-hmm. So those so-called opposition groups have to realize that they're not engaged in a democratic struggle. They're engaged in a liberation struggle, the second liberation of Africa, of their own countries after colonialism. You have to go through that stage, right? New constitutions that grant everybody the freedom that they deserve in order to operate in a real, true democratic space, then you can say we are moving on the path of democracy to hopefully a sense of true freedom.
Suleiman, there's one thing that is very intriguing. Why do these people who are in power right now, why do they fear the opposition? Why do they fear alternative views?
I think it is just greed. Let's accept it is greed. Some of these leaders, unfortunately, they are propelled in power by different circumstances. For example, we have got a team in East Africa which went to the bush. They were just individuals who went, got guns and mobilized people and used the social, political and economic circumstances in the countries where they are to overthrow the governments. And some of them were really very, very poor. People like Museveni were literally very poor. If you find the group which came with the people like Museveni, these were people like Kagame. Many of these guys were even refugees from camps, refugees in the country in Uganda where they are. So they got opportunity to go in government, and for the first time they saw what riches are, and now they cannot give out power because they are very rich and they have got everything. So eventually they become glued in the seats where they are sitting. But now the only good part about it is that they have stayed for so long. Those who would have replaced them have died. If you look across the country, in Angola, people like Savimbi died, Gakama died, Shangarai died, Olympio, the other side, is retiring. Even in Uganda, people like Besigye are almost retiring. Now there is a gap, and they have reached their peak, and they have not started transition themselves. So what is happening, as you have said, young people are ready to overrun them, the way they did in Burkina Faso. Now there is a wave in East Africa. Bobi Wine is combining with young people in Kenya. There is Rugara and the Victoria Ngabile in Rwanda. And then we have got our Chamisa in Zimbabwe. So we have got a new generation now which is going to use the youth to overthrow them. The unfortunate part of it is that they have destroyed the country and they may not have a good transition, which may lead to chaos.
Listening to you, most of you seem to have faith in the youth turning things around.
That's true. You know, politicians, like they say, like diapers, need constant changing, and both for the same reasons. Mm. So it's not good to have leaders succeeding themselves, like we have seen in many African countries, a person going for 20, 30 years as the president. I mean, look at President Barack Obama, very popular, you know, with the American people. Mm. Two terms, and he was saying that, you remember that time he went to the AU and said,
if I ran now,
yes,
I
can
win.
But
yes.
His hair was gray, which means he was doing something. But you wonder with African leaders what they'll be doing for 30 years. But of course, the youths are the future. You know, like Frantz Fanon said, that every generation out of relative obscurity must discover its mission, fulfill it, or betray it. So I hope with this youth bulge, Africa can be able to move forward from dictatorship.
That, I'm sorry, I'm going to disappoint you because I have over years, I'm no longer a youth. I don't think I think I'm getting to an age where I can speak with that level of confidence. Yeah. That I think the myth about the youth being the hope and the future is totally misguided. What Africa needs is good people with good intentions, whether they are old or young, women or men, who can overthrow the systems and entrench true democracy and the constitutions that are homegrown and actually protect the freedoms of every individual. Why do I debunk this thing about youth? Who are the African leaders who are these old men of today? They were youth when they were, some of them were in the bush. Some of them when the independence came, there were people in their 20s. Kabila of the DRC became president at the age of 29. He was a youth. What example has he set as a person who became president, as a young person? All these men we've seen across Africa came into power as young people.
Yep.
Even in Kenya today, the people who have been abusing power today, we looked at them with hope that they were young people. But we've seen attempts to abuse power. If it wasn't for the constitution that is strong and the people are aware, those very same people who are seen as the hope of the country because they are relatively younger have proved that just being young on its own does not protect a country from excesses. You need institutions. You need people who will be championing, not taking just taking over, but changing, entrenching systems that will protect the citizens against the excesses of their leaders, whether they are young, old, women or men.
Unfortunately, those same very leaders have destroyed all the institutions. So that begs the question, if the opposition can't do it, if the youth, as you say, may be acting out of desperation, because you can look at the joblessness.
The problem is we've seen young people get into that power, taste the power, the sweetness of ill-gotten wealth, and suddenly they change into exactly what those older leaders were.
They say if you fight a monster for a long time, you end up behaving like one.
Exactly. 10 seconds, Suleiman.
Actually, we are not disagreeing with dissent. We are not saying the youth should govern. We are saying the youth should help to overthrow the regime because they need some energy to the way they have entrenched themselves. Otherwise, the countries are in total desperation. A country like Uganda has economically collapsed. A country like Rwanda politically collapsed. A country like DRC economically and politically collapsed. But they need very well-educated, very intelligent and well-experienced people to put back the system to work.
But
so we need the help of the youth, but we also need very well-experienced and patriotic people.
You need the help the help of the youth, but you don't want Bobby Wine to inherit Museveni's system. You don't want...
It must be dismantled.
It has to be dismantled. So it's not about Bobby Wine.
10 seconds, blessings. Talking of dismantling,
exactly.
Zimbabwe, something has to be dismantled for things to start afresh. 10 seconds.
Yeah.
That's very true. I think, unfortunately, we inherited... you know, the colonial institutions, and nothing much has changed. And there is indeed a need for change in order for the country to move forward.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. That wraps up this edition of Reporters Roundtable. I'd like to thank our great panel, Blessing Zulu, VOA's Zim Service, Vincent Makori, VOA's Africa 54 host, and Suleiman Mugula, an independent political analyst. Gentlemen, thanks very much for being on the show.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Pleasure is ours.
Our producer was Kwame Ofori, and we'll be back again next week with another edition of Reporters Roundtable. I'm Douglas Simpoka, wishing you all the best.
This is VOA News. I'm Nicole.